Welcome to the History Maps podcast. You know, when you look at an architectural blueprint of a modern city, everything is perfectly color-coded.
Right, like the commercial zones are mapped in a neat blue and the residential areas are shaded in yellow.
Exactly. And the industrial sectors just sit quietly in gray. It is clean, it is categorized, and, well, it makes perfect logical sense on paper.
Yeah, but it represents a totally top-down, purely theoretical view of human organization. I mean, it's just a planner sitting in an office deciding how millions of people ought to live and trade based on a rigid set of rules.
But then you actually step out of that office and walk the streets of that city, and that neat color-coded map completely fails to capture the lived reality. The lines blur immediately.
Oh, absolutely. You find a bustling bakery operating out of a residential basement, or, you know, a sprawling factory with cramped apartments built right on top of it.
Right. The lived reality is this tangled, organic, and often chaotic web that the pristine blueprint completely ignores. And for 3,000 years, the Indian subcontinent has basically operated on a hidden map just like this.
Yeah, but one written not in municipal zoning laws, but in blood, DNA, and, well, ritual purity.
Which is exactly what we're getting into today. We are exploring the intricate history and enduring reality of the Indian caste system. We are going to untangle the ancient texts from the historical realities, track the system's evolution from a fluid occupational framework into a rigid social hierarchy, and examine the profound impact of colonial administration.
And the necessity of this exploration really comes down to how frequently the system is misunderstood. Mm-hmm. From the outside, it is often viewed as just a purely religious phenomenon, like a quirk of theology.
But the sources reveal a far more complex fusion of economics, genetics, and intense political engineering, right?
Exactly. Furthermore, it is a system that crossed theological boundaries centuries ago. It affects nearly every religious group on the Indian subcontinent today.
So to understand how this hidden architecture actually works on a daily basis, we first have to separate the ancient theory from the daily reality, which means we need to unpack two entirely different concepts that are, well, frequently conflated, Varna and Jati.
Distinguishing between those two terms is really the essential starting point for any serious analysis. When observers outside of India talk about the caste system, they are almost exclusively referring to Varna.
Varna is that theoretical, ideological, fourfold blueprint we just mentioned.
Right. The classical Sanskrit texts divide society into four broad, fixed categories. At the top, you have the Brahmins, who functioned as the priests, scholars, and preservers of sacred knowledge.
Okay.
And below them are the Kshatriyas, the warriors and rulers tasked with protection and governance.
And the merchants.
Yes, the Vaishyas. They are the merchants, agriculturalists, and traders who form the economic backbone. And finally, you have the Shudras, the laborers, and service providers whose duty was to serve the other three groups.
So that is the neat color-coded map. But crucially, there is a massive demographic that sits entirely outside of this blueprint. The Avarnas, or Dalits, who are historically referred to as untouchables.
Yeah, they were structurally excluded from the Varna system altogether. So Varna gives us the theory, gives us the broad philosophical categories, but Jati is the actual street level.
Jati is what determines your daily existence.
Literally. The word Jati translates to birth. Instead of four broad theoretical categories, the subcontinent is home to thousands of highly localized, highly specific Jatis.
And these are predominantly occupational groups, right?
Exactly. You do not just have generic class of laborers. You have specific localized communities of weavers, goldsmiths, leather workers, toddy tappers, or carpenters. And the defining inescapable feature of a Jati is endogamy.
Which means the boundaries are biological. You do not simply work within your Jati. You are fundamentally required to marry within your specific group.
Yeah. Wealth never leaves the group. Land never leaves the group. And genetic material never leaves the group. It creates this completely closed loop that sustains itself over generations.
And that closed loop dictates everything. I mean, you marry within your Jati, you eat with your Jati, and your entire social security network is your Jati.
Right. A person might theoretically belong to the broad Shudravarna in the classical texts,
right,
but their actual lived daily life, their immediate economic reality, and their entire universe of marriage prospects are dictated solely by their specific local Jati.
Which brings up a comparison that I think trips up a lot of people trying to understand this from a Western perspective.
How so?
Well, listeners might look at these four Varnas and immediately equate them to Western feudal estates, you know, the clergy, the nobility, and the commoners in medieval Europe. Or they might look at the occupational Jatis and compare them to modern socioeconomic classes.
Ah, yeah. But our sources are emphatic that treating the Indian caste system like a Western class system is a fundamental error in analysis.
It is an error because the two systems operate on completely different axes of value. Like the French anthropologist Louis Dumont analyzed this deeply in his work on what he termed Homo hierarchicus.
Right, Dumont. He noted that Western systems of social stratification separate power, status, and class based on material wealth and individual equality. In a Western framework, if you acquire enough material wealth, your social status almost invariably rises to meet your bank account.
Economic power eventually purchases social prestige. The self-made industrialist builds an empire, buys the massive estate, and eventually gets invited to the royal ball. Capital dictates status.
Exactly. Capital is the ultimate solvent for class boundaries in the West. But the Indian system, as Dumont argued, is a holistic hierarchy grounded entirely in the concepts of ritual purity and ritual pollution.
In this specific framework, cosmic order, which is known as Dharma, completely subordinates pure economic or political power.
Right. Your status is defined by your inherent ritual purity, derived from your birth, not by the size of your agricultural holdings or the strength of your private militia.
Okay, wait. Reading the text is one thing, but human nature is universally drawn to power and capital. If this system isn't fundamentally about wealth, how does that actually play out in a village?
What do you mean?
Well, suppose you have a wealthy merchant who owns half the land in the region and a poor priest who owns nothing. Doesn't the money eventually buy the status? Surely the wealthy landowner doesn't actually bow down to someone simply because of theoretical ritual purity.
That is precisely where the Western framework fails to comprehend the lived reality of caste. In the traditional framework, ritual purity operates independently of and is superior to material wealth. Let us look at that exact village scenario you just brought up.
Okay.
You have a Brahmin priest who might be entirely impoverished. He lives on daily alms, he holds zero direct political power, and he possesses no material assets to speak of. Yet he retains absolute peak ritual status.
Because he is considered inherently ritually pure by virtue of his birth.
And his adherence to specific conduct, yes. Conversely, you could have a Vaishya merchant or a Shudra landowner in that same village who is immensely wealthy, possessing vast tracts of fertile land and employing hundreds of agricultural workers.
A local titan of industry.
A local titan. Yet that wealthy landowner absolutely cannot buy the ritual purity of the impoverished Brahmin. The wealthy Vaishya or Shudra must still observe physical and social deference to the Brahmin in any ritual context.
So the landowner, despite all his capital, cannot officiate a sacred ceremony.
No, he cannot.
Yeah.
He cannot recite the specific Vedic chants required to bless his own home. And historically, the Brahmin would never accept cooked food from that wealthy landowner.
Because doing so would transmit ritual pollution from the lower status landowner to the higher status priest.
Exactly. The hierarchy of purity is absolute, and it stands entirely distinct from the hierarchy of wealth. This rigid separation of purity and power is the defining, unique feature of the caste system.
So we are looking at a society organized around an axis of sacrality rather than purely an axis of capital. It is a system where the cosmic ledger matters more than the economic ledger.
That is a great way to put it.
But looking at the earliest historical sources, it did not start out with this absolute rigid lock-in. If we trace the ancient origins, we see a distinct trajectory from a fluid occupational model to a permanent genetic lock-in.
Yeah, to trace those origins, we have to travel back to the Indo-Aryan migrations into the northwestern Indian subcontinent, which occurred roughly around 1500 BCE.
These were pastoral nomadic groups moving into the region, right?
They were, and they brought with them early social structures, linguistic frameworks, and religious practices that would eventually be formalized and codified in the ancient texts known as the Vedas.
And the foundational text here is the Rig Veda. Specifically, in the 10th mandala of the Rig Veda, there is a highly significant hymn called the Purusha Sukta.
Yes, it describes the creation of the universe through the cosmic sacrifice of a primordial being named Purusha.
And the hymn explicitly links the origin of the four Varnas to the physical anatomy of this cosmic being.
The imagery is both literal and deeply symbolic. According to the hymn, the Brahmins emerged from the mouth of Purusha. This symbolizes speech, the preservation of knowledge, and the vital recitation of sacred chants.
And the Kshatriyas.
They emerged from his arms, which represents martial strength, protection, and the wielding of weapons. The Vaishyas came from his thighs, denoting the sturdy foundation of economic productivity and agricultural support.
And the Shudras were produced from his feet.
indicating manual labor, movement, and service to the rest of the body.
It is a physiological metaphor for a functional, interdependent society. Everyone forms part of the exact same organism. A body needs a head to think, arms to defend, thighs to stand, and feet to move.
Right, but the crucial takeaway from our sources regarding the early Vedic period is that this society was relatively fluid. Your role in the body wasn't permanently welded to your lineage.
That fluidity is a defining characteristic of the early era. In the early Vedic society, social roles were largely based on two concepts rather than strict heredity. The first is guna,
which refers to your innate qualities, tendencies, or natural aptitudes.
And the second is karma, which refers to your conduct, your actions, and your chosen profession.
Exactly. So if you were born into a family of warriors, but you possessed a deep natural aptitude for memorizing sacred chants, understanding complex theology, and performing rituals, you could function within society as a priest.
There was no rigid, insurmountable wall of heredity.
None at all. And vitally, at this stage in history, there was absolutely no concept of untouchability. The boundaries between the different functional groups were porous.
But that porous nature did not survive the transition into the classical period. As we move into the era stretching roughly from 200 BCE to 200, the architecture of the system hardened dramatically.
Yeah, this is the period when monumental legal and ethical texts, most notably the Manus Ritis, were composed and codified.
And the Manus Riti, often referred to as the Laws of Manu, marks a seismic shift in how society was organized.
It really does. It took the fluid concepts of the Vedas and formalized them into a strict, punitive hierarchy. It heavily restricted intervarna marriage. The text is highly preoccupied with defining specific, severe penalties for what it called varna sankara, or the mixing of classes.
The authors of the text viewed the mixing of different social categories as a direct threat to cosmic stability. It is a profound paranoia about contamination.
That is exactly what it is. The text treats the crossing of social boundaries not just as a legal violation, but as a spiritual catastrophe.
And most notably, this classical period is where the horrific concept of untouchability is formally codified.
Right. Groups that dealt with tasks considered ritually polluting, like handling human corpses, sweeping human waste, or working with the skins of dead animals for leather.
They were physically, spatially, and socially isolated from the rest of society.
Yes. The pollution was no longer just about the temporary state of a person after a specific act. The pollution became an inherent, permanent trait assigned to their lineage.
The sources provide a really powerful narrative vignette to illustrate just how deeply these boundaries penetrated the cultural psyche. It comes from the ancient, sprawling epic, the Mahabharata. It is the story of a young man named Ekalavya.
Ah, yes. Ekalavya was a tribal youth, born entirely outside the traditional sanctioned Varna structure. He desperately wanted to learn the noble art of archery, so he approached Drona.
And Drona was the legendary elite royal teacher of the Kshatriya princes. Ekalavya asks to be a student, and Drona outright rejects him simply because of his low birth.
But Ekalavya is driven by an intense dedication. He retreats to the forest, builds a crude clay statue of Drona to serve as his symbolic guru, and practices relentlessly in front of it.
Through sheer willpower and innate talent, he becomes a master archer. He becomes so incredibly skilled, in fact, that he inadvertently surpasses Arjuna.
And Arjuna is Drona's star pupil and the favored Kshatriya prince.
Right. And when Drona ventures into the forest and discovers this tribal youth who has outclassed his royal students, he doesn't reward Ekalavya's dedication. He doesn't recruit him.
Instead, to protect the martial supremacy of the Kshatriya class, Drona manipulates the situation.
Since Ekalavya learned in front of Drona's statue, Drona claims the right of a teacher's fee, a guru dakshina. He asks Ekalavya to cut off his own right thumb and present it to him.
And Ekalavya immediately complies. He severs his gum, destroying his physical ability to shoot a bow forever.
We have to pause and look at the psychological mechanics of why Ekalavya does this. I mean, he is a superior warrior. He is armed. He could easily refuse or even strike Drona down.
But he complies because of the overwhelming internalized weight of Dharma. Defying his designated place, defying a Brahmin teacher, would mean violating the cosmic order.
The story illustrates that physical prisons were not necessary to enforce the hierarchy. The psychological conditioning of Dharma and karma acted as an invisible, omnipresent police force.
It is a brutal illustration of how the system actively suppressed the upward mobility of anyone outside the designated hierarchy, framing their suppression as a moral duty.
It is a chilling story, but we have to look at the context of who is telling it. Texts like the Manusmriti and epics like the Mahabharata represent an idealized, highly elite Brahmin worldview.
They are the perspective of the people sitting at the very top of the hierarchy, writing the rules that benefit them the most.
Reading the Manusmriti feels like reading a billionaire's ideal tax code, you know? It is an elite fantasy. Human beings fall in love, they travel, they rebel. Surely average farmers and artisans weren't strictly adhering to these Brahminical marriage rules just because a scroll told them to.
For over a century, historians and sociologists debated that exact question. Was the vast corpus of Sanskrit texts merely an elite fantasy, a theoretical utopia imagined by priests? Or did it reflect a sociological reality that average people actually lived by?
And to answer that definitively, we had to wait for modern science. We had to look away from ancient, decaying manuscripts and look at the cutting edge of population genetics, the DNA evidence.
Yes. Recent, highly sophisticated studies in population genetics have completely reshaped our understanding of this history. Most notably, a landmark study led by geneticist Priya Moorjani and her colleagues mapped the genetic ancestry of hundreds of distinct Indian populations. They were looking for specific signatures of admixture.
Explain how that works. What exactly are they looking for in the blood?
Admixture is the genetic term for the mixing of different populations. When individuals from two distinct genetic backgrounds have children, those children inherit large, unbroken segments of DNA from both groups.
Okay, I follow.
Over successive generations, through a process called recombination, those large segments are broken down into smaller and smaller pieces. By measuring the length of these shared genetic segments in a modern population, geneticists can mathematically calculate exactly how many generations ago the mixing occurred.
Oh, wow. I mean, it is like a biological clock ticking backward.
Exactly. The geneticists mapped the entire subcontinent, analyzing the interactions between what they term ancestral North Indians and ancestral South Indians. What they found was absolutely staggering.
Prior to the classical period, the genetic data shows widespread, extensive admixture across the subcontinent. People were moving, mixing, and marrying across community lines, completely ignoring the strict theoretical boundaries.
Which confirms the fluidity of the early Vedic period. People were just living their lives.
But then the biological clock shows a massive, unprecedented halt. Suddenly, between the years 100 and 400, the genetic data shows that strict endogamy locked into place across the population. The intergroup admixture effectively ceased.
Meaning thousands of localized communities simultaneously stopped marrying outside their specific jati. They pulled up the drawbridges.
Completely. And this sudden genetic lock-in perfectly, undeniably coincides with the exact period when texts like the Manusmriti were codified and aggressively promoted.
The rules written by the elites didn't just stay on the scrolls. They were enforced, adopted, and internalized to such an extreme degree that they left a permanent, verifiable signature in the DNA of over a billion people.
Once the system locked in around the year 400, those genetic boundaries were fiercely maintained for the next two millennia. It is a breathtaking piece of verifiable history.
The texts literally re-engineer the human genome in South Asia.
But if the DNA proves these groups completely stopped intermarrying and sharing genetic ties by the year 400, how on earth did they survive economically?
What do you mean?
Well, if you are a tiny community of weavers and you refuse to integrate with the carpenters or the farmers, how do you handle a bad harvest or lack of resources? That absolute isolation forced a bizarre economic workaround, which brings us into the medieval period.
You have hit on the central logistical problem of the caste system. Between the years 500 and 1500, society became vastly more complex.
The four broad varnas were entirely insufficient to organize a rapidly developing agricultural and artisanal economy.
You needed specialized skills. This is when the thousands of specific occupational jatis truly proliferated. They began to function similarly to closed trade guilds, known historically as shrenis.
So if you were born into a family of potters, you were a potter, period. You married a potter.
The specific techniques of pottery, the sourcing of the clay, the firing temperatures, these were proprietary secrets kept fiercely guarded within your jati.
Yes, they were knowledge monopolies based on birth. But because of endogamy, these monopolies couldn't just merge or buy each other out.
So they had to be knit together in rural areas through an incredibly intricate economic network called the Jajmani system.
Explain the mechanics of the Jajmani system, because it sounds like a hyper-local subscription economy, where canceling your subscription means you starve.
That is a highly accurate way to frame it. The Jajmani system was a rural economic network of permanent, reciprocal exchange.
At the center of a village, you had the patron castes.
Usually the dominant landowning jetas who controlled the agricultural output. These patrons required a multitude of specialized services to run their estates and their lives. They needed carpenters to build plows, barbers to cut hair, blacksmiths to forge tools, and sweepers to clean waste.
But instead of paying these service jetas with cash, which was scarce and fluctuated in value, the patrons provided them with a fixed, hereditary share of the agricultural harvest and sometimes small plots of land to live on.
A completely cashless barter system based on hereditary obligation.
Exactly. The local blacksmith jeti had a sacred hereditary duty to make and repair agricultural tools for the landowner jeti. He didn't send an invoice, he just did the work.
In return, the landowner had a sacred hereditary duty to ensure the blacksmith's family received a specific weight of grain after every single harvest. This system created immense local economic resilience.
In times of severe famine or drought, the patron was socially and morally expected to dip into their reserves to support their service castes.
You didn't let your blacksmith starve, because you couldn't just hire another one from outside the village network.
But the flip side of that resilience is absolute stagnation. It completely stifled innovation. If a brilliant young carpenter had a revolutionary idea for a new irrigation tool, but it involved metalwork, he couldn't just switch trades.
No, he couldn't open a hybrid wood and metal workshop. The boundaries were fixed. He was trapped in his subscription tier.
The economic silos were impermeable. And those silos were enforced on a daily basis, not just by the threat of economic ruin, but by the relentless daily application of the purity principle.
The hierarchy dictated exactly who could touch whom, where they could walk, and most importantly, who could share food and water.
The mechanics of purity around food exchange are endlessly fascinating. It is not just about who you invite to dinner.
Food is the ultimate vector for ritual pollution, because it involves taking something external from the physical world and putting it inside your internal body. It crosses the ultimate boundary.
According to the daily lived rules of caste, higher castes could not accept cooked food or water from lower castes without risking profound spiritual defilement.
The very act of a Dalit drawing water from a village well was seen as polluting the entire water source for the upper castes.
If a Brahmin accidentally consumed water from a clay vessel touched by someone from a polluting caste, the Brahmin was considered heavily polluted.
Right.
What happens then? Does he lose his status permanently?
Not permanently, but he had to undergo complex, arduous purification rituals. This involved rigorous bathing, fasting, the consumption of purifying substances like ghee or cow urine, and the recitation of specific mantras to restore his baseline ritual status.
The daily life of a high caste individual was a constant, exhausting navigation of spatial and physical boundaries to avoid contamination.
Very much so.
I have to pause here because human beings naturally resist this kind of absolute oppression. We are talking about a system that rigidly locks people into social and economic silos based entirely on birth and polices their every interaction, their every meal with terrifying rules about cosmic pollution.
Yeah, it is intense.
Surely people didn't just accept this for 1,000 years. Did anyone within this medieval society try to dismantle the architecture of this system?
Absolutely. The medieval period was not a monolith of quiet acceptance. It saw massive, widespread internal resistance, most notably through the phenomenon known as the Bhakti movement.
The Bhakti movement was essentially a wave of radical, devotional spirituality that swept across the subcontinent, right?
Yes. It emerged in the south around the 7th century and slowly swept northward. The core philosophy of the Bhakti movement emphasized a direct, intensely personal relationship with the divine.
It fundamentally bypassed the need for elite Brahmin priests, it bypassed the complex Sanskrit rituals, and it bypassed the entire hierarchy of purity.
Right. The sources mention several key figures, like Basava in the south and later Kabir in the north.
Let us talk about how they actively fought the system.
Well, reformers like Basava, a 12th century philosopher in Karnataka, and Kabir, a 15th century mystic poet in Varanasi, vehemently critiqued Brahminical exclusivity. They preached absolute spiritual equality.
Kabir, who himself belonged to a low-status, marginalized weaving jati, composed brilliant, piercing poems mocking the blatant hypocrisy of ritual purity.
He asked how a priest could consider himself pure while harboring malice, or how water could be polluted by a touch when the same water flowed through the veins of all humans.
And Basava went even further. He established an egalitarian spiritual community called the Anubhava Mantapa. he actively encouraged intercaste dining.
Which, as we discussed, was a massive taboo.
Right, and he even facilitated intercaste marriages, directly defying the core genetic tenets of the system.
So they had mass followings, they were deeply influential, they preached absolute equality and actively broke the rules.
Why didn't the system collapse under that pressure?
Because while the Bhakti movement offered profound spiritual solace and established undeniable theological equality, it fundamentally failed to dismantle the jati structures on a material economic level.
You could go to a Bhakti gathering on a Tuesday evening, sit as an absolute equal with someone from a different caste, sing devotional hymns, and share a communal meal.
But on Wednesday morning, when you went back to your village, your physical survival still depended entirely on the Jajmani system.
The economics trumped the theology.
Exactly. The networks of grain exchange, the patron-client obligations, and the massive kinship networks of marriage were simply too deeply entrenched. If you actually followed through and broke your caste rules permanently, say, by marrying outside your jati, you were excommunicated.
You lost your livelihood, your right to village grain, and your entire family network.
The spiritual rebellion of the Bhakti saints was beautiful, but it could not overcome the brutal, practical, economic reality of the medieval village.
The system survived its internal critiques for centuries. It absorbed the theological pressure and maintained its economic architecture. But this ancient, intricate web would undergo its most radical and violent transformation when a foreign corporate power took control of the subcontinent.
The map was about to be forcibly redrawn. The arrival of the British East India Company and the subsequent establishment of the formal British Raj completely rewired the socio-political architecture of Indian society.
We are looking at a vast timeline stretching from roughly 1757 after the decisive Battle of Plassey all the way up to Indian independence in 1947.
Right. And to understand this, put yourself in the shoes of an early British administrator arriving in India.
You are part of a relatively minuscule colonial force trying to govern millions of people.
You need to collect taxes efficiently, you need to extract resources, and you need to maintain civil order to keep the profits flowing. To do that, you have to make sense of a society that operates on rules you cannot even begin to perceive.
The British administrators were raised in a European culture of written law, fixed bureaucratic categories, and centralized authority. They simply could not comprehend the fluidity, the regional variations, and the unwritten, localized practices of thousands of different jatis.
They demanded legibility. They needed to know who was who and what laws governed them. To understand what they called Hindu law, early British scholars and administrators, like Sir William Jones, relied heavily on elite Brahmin scholars to act as their translators, informants, and legal advisors.
So the British walk into the village, completely confused, and ask the guys at the very top of the purity hierarchy to explain how the entire system works.
Precisely. And predictably, the Brahmins pointed the British toward ancient classical texts like the Manusmriti.
The British took these ancient texts, which, as we discussed earlier, were highly idealized, rigid frameworks prioritizing supreme Brahminical authority, and inadvertently elevated them into uniform modern colonial law.
This historical process is often referred to as Brahminization. The British colonial courts took incredibly diverse, regional, and often flexible community customs and forcefully replaced them with a rigid textual theory applied uniformly across the entire subcontinent.
But the most devastating tool of this colonial rigidification wasn't just the courts. It was the spreadsheet. It was the census.
In 1871, the British conducted a massive, unprecedented decennial census of the entire Indian population.
Let us dive deeply into Herbert Risley, the colonial administrator who spearheaded a lot of this categorization, because his methods were heavily influenced by some very dark European trends.
Herbert Risley was deeply embedded in the pseudoscientific racial theories that were highly prevalent in Victorian Europe at the time. He believed that human behavior, intelligence, and social hierarchy were biologically determined and physically measurable.
Risley and the census administrators set out to enumerate and categorize the entire Indian population into a neat top-down hierarchy. To do this, Risley utilized anthropometry. Explain exactly what that looked like on the ground.
It was the literal physical measurement of human bodies. Risley dispatched officials across the subcontinent armed with calipers. They measured people's skull shapes, their height, and most obsessively their nasal index, the width and length of their noses.
Risley operated on the flawed theory that the upper castes were pure Aryan descendants with fine, narrow noses, and the lower castes were indigenous non-Aryan races with broader noses.
They forced thousands of fluid, localized occupational jadeus to register under fixed, broad, biologically defined categories based on these absurd physical measurements.
Just imagine being a local farmer or a weaver. Suddenly, a foreign official arrives, measures the width of your nose with metal calipers, and uses that number to officially define your entire community's tax burden, social standing, and job eligibility for the rest of written history.
By doing this, the British transformed fluid social identities into highly rigid, hyper-politicized categories.
The psychological and political impact was catastrophic. Because suddenly, your official classification in the British census determined your access to government jobs, your eligibility for military recruitment, and your fundamental legal rights.
The census created a zero-sum game. Castes began actively lobbying the British government, producing fabricated genealogies to be classified higher up the bureaucratic ladder.
It turned a complex, interdependent social network into a rigid, competitive instrument of state control.
And for some groups, that state control evolved into unimaginable systematic brutality. We have to look at the Criminal Tribes Act of 1871. It is one of the most chilling pieces of legislation from the colonial era.
Influenced heavily by the rising global movement of eugenics, the British colonial government decided that certain nomadic, forest-dwelling, or marginalized jadis were not just engaged in specific unconventional trades, but were quite literally born criminals.
They labeled entire communities, millions of people, as criminal by birth.
It was absolute guilt by heredity. If you were born into one of these specific jadis, the colonial state legally defined you as a criminal from the moment you took your first breath, regardless of your actions.
The enforcement was draconian. The British forced these designated communities into isolated, heavily policed barbed wire settlements.
They initiated mass, mandatory fingerprinting campaigns to track their every movement, decades before fingerprinting was standard police practice elsewhere.
If a member of a criminal tribe was found outside their designated area without a pass, they were immediately arrested. It was the weaponization of caste identity to a horrific totalitarian degree.
So this naturally leads to a massive historical thought experiment. It is a debate that rages in academic circles today.
The question of what would have happened without the British?
Exactly. If the British hadn't arrived, if they hadn't conducted these meticulous censuses, if they hadn't passed laws like the Criminal Tribes Act, would the caste system have naturally faded away as India modernized and urbanized? Or were the British just meticulously documenting and utilizing a system of oppression that was already deeply embedded?
It is arguably the most fiercely debated question in modern South Asian history. To navigate it, we have to synthesize the views of prominent scholars like Nicholas Dirks, who wrote Castes of Mind.
And Dirks argues clearly, and the evidence supports him, that the British absolutely did not invent caste. The genetic evidence of endogamy from the year 400, the harsh strictures of the Manus Ridi, the exploitative mechanics of the Drashmani system, all of that predates the British arrival by centuries or millennia.
But what the British did was weaponize and rigidify the system in entirely new, inescapable ways.
They took away whatever regional flexibility existed.
Precisely. Before the British bureaucracy, the system possessed a certain organic elasticity. A specific jati might migrate to a new region, gradually gain wealth through a new trade, hire genealogists to rewrite their history, adopt Brahminical rituals like vegetarianism, a process called Sanskritization, and slowly rise in the local status hierarchy over a few generations.
The British census completely froze that mobility. By writing caste directly into modern bureaucratic law, they stripped away the regional flexibility. They turned an organic, albeit oppressive, social and economic network into a rigid, inescapable legal cage of the modern state.
And this rigid categorization wasn't just restricted to the Hindu majority. The sheer cultural gravity of the system, combined with the heavy hand of colonial administrators, ensured that caste boundaries bled into every single community on the subcontinent.
Which brings us to a massive, widespread misconception. We have to look beyond Hinduism and examine the incredibly pervasive nature of caste across different theologies.
The misconception that caste is exclusively a Hindu phenomenon is pervasive globally, but the historical sources and sociological data show it is entirely false. The mechanics of the system permeate nearly all religious demographics in India.
Let us unpack how this manifests in Islam, because the contrast is jarring. Theologically, Islam fundamentally preaches the absolute equality of all believers before God. In a mosque, a king and a beggar stand shoulder to shoulder in prayer.
Yet in South Asia, we see a distinct, rigid hierarchy within the Muslim community.
Yes, within South Asian Muslim communities, you find the deeply entrenched Ashraf-Ajlaf dichotomy. The Ashrafs are those families who claim noble foreign descent, tracing their ancestral lineage back to Arab, Persian, or Afghan origins.
Because they represent the historical invading ruling class and the initial wave of Islamic scholars, they hold significantly higher social and cultural status.
The Ajlafs, on the other hand, are the descendants of local indigenous Indian populations who converted to Islam over the centuries. Even within these Islamic communities, the core mechanism of caste endogamy is heavily practiced.
Historically, Ashraf families absolutely refused to marry into Ajlaf families, maintaining their bloodlines just as strictly as Hindu upper castes.
It is the exact same underlying hardware of birth-based status and endogamy, just running a different theological software. And we see the exact same thing play out in Christianity.
Let us look at the Christian communities in the southern state of Kerala. You have the Syrian Christians, who claim their ancestors were high-caste Brahmins converted directly by the Apostle Thomas in the first century.
Historically, they maintained incredibly strict purity laws, acting very much like an upper caste Jati within the local ecosystem.
And you must contrast them with Dalit Catholics. These are communities that converted to Christianity in the 19th and 20th centuries, specifically to escape the brutal stigma, the crushing poverty, and the physical oppression of untouchability within Hinduism.
They sought the egalitarian embrace of the church. Yet the sociological sources detail how they report enduring intense segregation even within their new religion.
There are documented accounts of segregated seating in parishes, where Dalits must sit on the floor while upper caste Christians sit on pews. There are reports of separate communion cups, separate entrances, and even physical walls dividing the burial grounds so the dead do not mix.
The religion changed, the prayers changed, but the physical and social boundaries remained entirely intact.
We even see echoes of it in Sikhism and Jainism. Both of these faiths originated, in large part, as egalitarian reform movements, specifically rebelling against Brahminical orthodoxy and ritual hierarchy.
Yet today, they still exhibit caste-like endogamy and distinct social divisions regarding marriage and leadership.
It is a striking, persistent contradiction across the entire subcontinent.
It really is, and it demands a deeper explanation. Religions like Islam, Christianity, and Sikhism have core theological doctrines of absolute human equality. If the Holy Book explicitly says everyone is equal, why doesn't that theological truth eventually erase the sociological caste lines?
How does a hierarchy based on birth survive the introduction of egalitarian theology?
Yeah, exactly.
It comes down to the fundamental mechanics of how these religions spread in India and the distinction between theological doctrine and sociological reality. When Islam or Christianity spread through the Indian subcontinent, they rarely converted isolated individuals one by one. Often, entire Jatis converted collectively.
They did this to escape social stigma, to gain political advantage under a new ruler, or to access new economic networks.
So a whole village community of weavers or an entire regional community of leather workers would convert to Islam or Christianity together as a unit.
Exactly. And when they converted, they brought their entire sociological architecture with them. They brought their occupational ties, their internal leadership structures, and most importantly, their kinship networks.
Endogamy, the ancient internalized insistence on marrying only within one's ancestral community, proved vastly stronger than any theological text. They might pray in a new language, but they still only married within their specific weaver or leatherworker community.
The religious software was updated, but the sociological hardware, the Jati, remained exactly the same.
Recognizing that caste permeated every facet of Indian society, across all religions, all regions, and all economic classes, the leaders of newly independent India faced a monumental, unprecedented task.
In 1947, the British colonial administration finally left. The new nation had to figure out how to legislate away a multi-millennial social order that was woven into the very DNA of the country.
This leads us to the post-independence era, the attempts at abolition, the massive scale of affirmative action, and the modern paradoxes we see today.
The primary architects of the Indian Constitution knew that a modern, secular democracy could not possibly function with the legal framework of caste still in place. This effort was led prominently by Dr. B.R. Ambedkar.
Ambedkar himself was a Dalit.
He possessed an absolute brilliant legal mind, but he had personally suffered immense degrading discrimination throughout his life. He intimately understood the brutal reality of the system.
Under his guidance, they took decisive historic action. In the 1950 Constitution, Article 17 formally and absolutely abolished untouchability and forbade its practice in any form.
But declaring a 3,000-year-old system abolished on a piece of paper doesn't magically erase thousands of years of entrenched economic and social disparity.
You can't just pass a law saying everyone is equal now and expect the playing field to level itself, especially when one group has exclusively owned all the arable land and hoarded all the educational access for centuries, and another group has been systematically violently denied both.
Dr. Ambedkar and the constitutional framers were highly pragmatic. They recognized that harsh reality.
Yep.
Therefore, they instituted what remains one of the world's most extensive, complex, and debated affirmative action programs, known in India as the reservation system.
Initially, the system targeted the most severely marginalized groups, designated legally as scheduled castes, which includes the Dalits and scheduled tribes, the indigenous populations.
The state legally reserved a specific, non-negotiable percentage of seats in government jobs, public sector enterprises, and public educational institutions exclusively for these groups, roughly proportional to their demographic population.
It was a massive intervention to force representation, and this system was dramatically, explosively expanded in the 1990s.
Yes, following the highly controversial recommendations of the Mandel Commission, the government recognized a sprawling middle layer of society.
There were many other jihadists that, while not suffering from the absolute physical exclusion of untouchability, were still historically disadvantaged, agrarian, and severely underrepresented in higher education and the halls of government.
These groups were categorized under a new bureaucratic label, other backward classes, or OBCs.
And the implementation of the Mandel Commission recommendations caused massive political upheaval.
It triggered fiery protests and reshaped the entire political landscape. Because when OBCs were officially added to the reservation system, it meant that nearly 50% of all public sector jobs and higher education seats across the nation were legally reserved for lower and middle castes.
Let us look at the mathematics of that geopolitical shift. By reserving half the seats, the state essentially created a massive fast-tracked pipeline for a new middle class among these historically marginalized communities.
It gave them access to state power, to bureaucracy, to police forces.
And politically, it led to the rise of massive, powerful regional political parties entirely based on mobilizing lower caste vote banks. But this massive intervention leads us to a fascinating modern paradox.
The paradox of the reservation system is profound. While reservations successfully and undeniably created unprecedented economic mobility and real political power for marginalized groups, they also simultaneously deeply entrenched caste identity in modern bureaucratic and political life.
To claim a reserved government job or a highly coveted engineering college seat, you have to prove your caste with a stamped government certificate. Politicians build electoral coalitions by promising increased reservation benefits to specific jihadis.
So rather than caste slowly fading away into irrelevance as India modernized, caste identity became a highly visible, highly vital currency for economic advancement and electoral survival.
So this brings us to the present day. If I walk into a modern, gleaming office building in a major tech hub like Bangalore or Hyderabad today, you have young people working in glass towers, writing complex software code, eating at international food courts connected to the global internet.
Right.
If I walk into that environment, will I see this ancient system at play, or has urbanization and globalization finally erased it?
The empirical data presents a highly nuanced dual reality. On a purely physical level, urbanization has absolutely eroded the strict ancient rules of purity and pollution.
In a crowded subway car in Delhi or a bustling corporate cafeteria in a Bangalore tech park, people are not checking the caste of the person sitting next to them. They are not investigating who cooked their lunch.
The daily visceral enforcement of physical untouchability and spatial segregation has heavily diminished in these anonymous urban spaces.
The blatant physical map of the village doesn't apply to the glass tower. But the hidden architecture hasn't disappeared, it has just adapted.
Exactly. The system is incredibly resilient. Caste has merely mutated to survive in the modern corporate economy. Statistical data shows that upper castes still hold vastly disproportionate amounts of inherited wealth.
They heavily dominate corporate leadership networks, national media boards, and the higher judiciary, and access to the highest paying private sector jobs often relies on informal, hidden referral networks.
A who-you-know economy.
Precisely. If a top-tier tech executive only hires people from their own elite university alumni networks or their own family social circles, and those social circles are completely defined by upper caste lineage, the exclusion continues seamlessly.
It operates without any explicit written rules being broken. It becomes an invisible architecture of privilege.
It is the invisible architecture, replacing the old visible walls. And the most critical statistic from all the sociological sources, the ultimate metric that proves the core hardware of the system is still functionally intact, relates to marriage.
Despite the massive tech hubs, despite smartphones, dating apps, and globalization, recent comprehensive surveys show that over 80 to 90% of all marriages in India today are still strictly intracaste.
That is the definitive, undeniable metric. Endogamy is, and always has been, the engine of the caste system.
As long as 80 to 90% of the population continues to arrange marriages exclusively within their specific jati, the kinship networks remain entirely closed.
The inherited wealth remains siloed within specific groups. The genetic and social boundaries drawn by the elites over 2,000 years ago remain heavily, voluntarily guarded by the population today. The architecture of the system is fundamentally intact.
This brings us to step back and consider what the future holds for this incredibly resilient system.
We have mapped its journey. We saw how it started as a theoretical, functional, occupational model in the ancient Vedic texts.
We saw how it locked into place genetically through strict marriage rules around the year 400.
We examine how it functioned as a vital, inescapable medieval economic web through the Jajmani system.
We saw how it was rigidly codified into modern law by the British census, and how it has now mutated into a powerful, invisible axis of political power and corporate networking in the modern world.
The defining lesson is that the Indian caste system is not a static, decaying relic of ancient religious texts. It is a highly adaptable, constantly evolving social technology.
It survives century after century because it constantly reinvents how it distributes power, resources, and social capital.
Which leaves us with a final, highly provocative thought regarding the future. Because as the Indian diaspora expands globally, moving into leadership positions worldwide, this intricate social technology is crossing oceans.
We are actively seeing it manifest in the tech corridors of Silicon Valley, where unprecedented lawsuits have recently been filed over caste-based discrimination in major multinational tech companies.
We are seeing it on massive international university campuses, where student bodies are currently fighting intense legal battles to add caste as a protected category against discrimination, right next to race and gender.
Foreign legal systems from California to the United Kingdom are now being forced to grapple with, define, and litigate these ancient caste dynamics within their own borders.
It forces a profound global reckoning. It demands that we ask fundamental questions about the nature and persistence of social hierarchies, regardless of geography.
The ultimate question for you to consider as you navigate the modern world is this. Can a social system built and refined over 3,000 years on the Indian subcontinent simply fade away in a globalized world? Or will it subtly, invisibly shape the new hierarchies of the global future?
When you look at the blueprint of our modern, hyper-connected cities and corporations, you have to wonder, are we truly building an egalitarian future? Or are we just drawing pristine new maps over the exact same ancient, tangled streets?
The architecture may be invisible to the untrained eye, but the foundations run 3 millennia deep.
Thank you for listening. History Maps. Learn history visually.